Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast shared on accessmedia.nz with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Hi folks, this is Richard here from Stonehenge Aotearoa, and this we're looking at the night sky at the moment. And Kaya will be joining us very shortly. Lots of roadworks going on, so I'm a little bit late getting to the studio, so I've left Kay with the responsibility of parking the car. Okay, so let's have a look at what we've got coming up. At Stonehenge, we're open at the moment from Wednesday to Sunday, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m, so you can come out on a self-guided tour at those times. We also do guided tours. That's when you get me to take you around the Henge and look at all the ancient stories and legends and why these things, which form the cornerstone to civilization, were built. And the other thing we do, of course, is night sky stuff. That's why I came out to the Wairarapa in the first place, originally from Wellington, hour and a quarter's drive, and we're out under these pristine night skies. And what we can do is Star Treks, and what we'll do is take you around the night sky. But those do need to be booked, both the guided tours and the Star Treks. And Kay's arrived now, so Kay, you can say hello.
Hello, everybody.
Anything to add to that?
Guided tours can be out of hours, but you do need to book them in. Okay, so the booking system will let you book them in when you're allowed to book them in. And that's days that we're not open to. And Star Trek, of course, is out of hours because it's at night time.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Okay, so let's turn on to a night sky. And I thought that we'd start off by looking at the bright stars in the early evening, looking to the north, the bright stars, and identify them. And it's very interesting that the brain has got this ability to recognise patterns and shapes, and once you begin to learn these stars, it becomes very much like you were a kid learning a map of the world. All right, so we're going to take you around some of the bright stars we've got there at the moment. The brightest is Arcturus, right? We've also got Vega, Altair, Antares and Spica, right? And what we will do over the next few weeks, we'll have a look at these stars in detail, all right? But overhead, of course, we've got the Scorpion, and Antares, of course, is the heart of the Scorpion. And the Scorpion is really easy to identify, and it wraps itself around the Milky Way. And that's the beautiful thing about our winter night sky.
Pardon?
Is that it, we get the most brilliant regions of the Milky Way come virtually directly overhead. But whipping down to the Milky Way near the horizon, we had the bright star Vega, is the constellation of Lyra, which is the Lyra as the...
It's like a little harp, yes, I suppose.
Harp, yeah, that's right. So, and that's Vega there. And and that is the fifth brightest star in the entire sky. And just pulled up a photograph of it, and you can see it's got a definite bluish sheen to it.
Right? Yeah, when you're looking at these pictures and you see the stars of different colours, it's real, okay? It's what it looks like through a telescope.
Yeah. If we were doing this to our sun, it would have a yellowish hue. Our sun's the predominant radiation is yellow visual wavelength. This one is obviously, a star is obviously a lot hotter than ours. And there we've got some information come up on distance of Vega is just over 25 light years, which makes it within the realms of being a local star, doesn't it, Kay?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. And it's more than twice the mass of the sun, and it's 57 times brighter. So it's hotter and brighter. And, of course, the luminosity of a normal star is very dependent upon its mass. So the amount of energy releasing from the star is directly related to its mass. And if you double the mass of a star, you don't just double the brightness. It goes up by about the fourth power, something like that. So,
and, of course, some of it you can't see with your eyes.
No,
some of it has, you know, it's not in the visual spectrum, it's outside it. So it could be, you could have stars that are infrared, that are below, and you could have stars that are above that are getting into ultraviolet.
That's right, yeah, that's right, yeah. And this is having a look. And this is actually a photograph, of course. And we can see the sun there, which I put down, Sol, and Vega. And this is using the knowledge we have of the sizes of the two stars. So you can see that Vega is not only brighter, but it's also a lot bigger.
It also looks a little bit oval.
It is, yeah. And this is because of its rapid rotation. All right. Rotation for Vega is it rotates on its axis in just over 16 hours.
Well, it's similar to Jupiter, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it is, yeah. The sun takes 25 days.
Which is similar to our month, if you look at it.
Well, yeah, but then you've got to remember that our sun also would have been rotating once when it was young. And what's happened is the tidal effect of the planets and
everything slowed it down.
Slowly slowed it down over millions and millions of years. So that's the size of Vega. But also, we know that surrounding Vega is a disk of white hot matter that's been hurled outwards. Right? And in that disk, new planets are actually forming. Now, this isn't what you're looking at on TV, is not a. A photograph of Vega, because we've never been able to get close enough to another star to photograph. It's based upon.
Oh, we have photographed one, but it doesn't look like that.
No, but I've. This is me, my artwork. I take all the information we know about a star and then build up what it would be looking like if you were standing on a planet like to Mercury or Venus or something like that. So this is this disk, but what we do know in Vega is that it's new planets are actually forming, and in that disk themselves, and two of the planets at this stage appear to be the size of Neptune. So that doesn't weigh out other planets. There's going to be lots of other planets there.
It's just easier to find the bigger ones.
Yeah, and of course what we're down to is because it is so young. Okay, now. The age of Vega is just 700 million years. Now, that sounds a bit old, doesn't it, Kay?
It does, until you compare it to our sun.
Which is 4.5 billion years old. Yeah, that's right. And so being just 700 million years old, it's pretty young. And consequently, any planets in there will also be
primordial.
Very primordial stage, yes. Hello, some guy's turned up there.
Looks
Hello,
like
Keith.
It's Keith.
How are you doing?
We're good. Okay, so if you go back to when our solar system was that age, I've got a picture here. Once again, it's not a photograph I've taken myself. It's a picture I've made up. It shows you moonrise 4 billion years ago, which is about... At that time, the planet Earth and the Moon would be about the same age as the planets we find around Vega at the moment. And the Moon looks very big, doesn't it? Yes, because the Moon was a lot closer. The Moon,
closer to the Earth, yes.
It's slowly moving away. All right. So
it
once upon a time,
it was huge. Faster.
Yeah. Yes.
Imagine the tides from a moon that big.
Absolutely.
I think they're 6 kilometres high or something similar like that. Yeah.
The Earth wouldn't have been a pleasant world to live in. It would be like one of those other worlds we're looking at around Vega at the moment.
Molten.
And eventually, all the atmosphere of the planet was all the water was in the atmosphere. And then at this stage, about that time, it began to...
Rain.
Cool and rain. And they reckoned it rained for non-stop for thousands and thousands of years.
So that wasn't for 40 days and 40 nights, that was thousands of years.
I would say so, yeah. Exactly. And it cooled the earth and also washed stuff down. But also in that process we find the origin of life. And what I thought maybe in the future we'll actually spin a program, we'll look at the evolution of our Earth and the Sun over its entire history. And
it would be interesting because an awful lot of minerals would have washed.
Oh,
I mean, it wasn't a sea. There wasn't water there. But as it developed water, the amount of rain still coming down must have washed a tremendous number of minerals into the sea, which would help when you're trying to get life going.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Mm. Yeah, well, we'll have a look at that. And, of course, this is one of the most interesting things of all is the origin of life.
Yes.
because it gives us a clue what may happen on other worlds, right? And the processes are, and when this all actually occurred and so on. So
yeah.
When you think of it, life, I mean, from the chemical, purely chemical point of view, life is unbelievably complex.
Mm.
You've got very millions of very intricate molecules which have to do their job exactly right. It's literally like the parts of a watch.
Absolutely. But the starting point, that complexity or the ingredients for that complexity have to be there at the beginning, don't they?
Yeah, there have been various theories and they're probably all right to a certain degree. It's just a matter of what was the spark in the end, isn't it?
And, of course, as far as life on the planet is concerned, the origin, we've only got one example we can look at, our own planet. Yes. And, of course, we're looking back billions of years in time trying to determine what happened.
Yes.
But that's going to change when we begin to look at new worlds.
And then we're learning a lot more about what's out there in space and these nebula, you know, these...
We're discovering some very interesting organic molecules.
That's right.
Out there in the...
Yes.
The gas and the dust between the stars, a lot of that's been discovered by radio astronomy, of course.
Well, I think we're at a stage where major discoveries and changes are being made in our knowledge. We're living in that era now. Yeah. I mean, just talking about planets, all my life people have talked about planets around other worlds, around other stars, but it was always a theory. Because we didn't have the technology to detect them. That's all changed. We now know of thousands of worlds out there.
Yeah. We were working at Carter Observatory when they discovered the first.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it's an hour working. We're still working, mind you. It's a bit unusual.
I remember the excitement when they found a planetary dust ring around the star Beta Pictoris, which is in the constellation of Pictor. And there's a huge amount of excitement. Even the news was full of it. The news the media usually aren't very interested in science, but there was a huge amount of excitement over it. And now, of course, yes, we're discovering Earth-like planets, possibly with oxygen atmospheres.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm. Well, this is it. So you won't normally find oxygen in an atmosphere. If you do detect oxygen, you're almost certain you know there's life there, right? Because normally oxygen is tied up with other chemicals, and we've got oxygen in our planet because we've got plants.
Well, you only have to look at Mars. I mean, it's rusty because the oxygen is combined with the rocks.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so the plants take the mineral out and release oxygen as a waste product.
Yeah, byproduct.
Which in turn is what animals and us use.
Yes, so it's a perfect symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Plants get their oxygen from the water.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need that. They want the hydrogen. They don't want the oxygen. So they breathe the oxygen out through their leaves and we breathe it in.
Yes, right, yeah. So, look, we must do some programs on this sort of thing.
I think so, because it's very relevant now, because what we're doing... One of the things we're doing is creating problems with the sea, and that's creating some dead patches in the sea now where there isn't any oxygen. And you can talk about on Earth, we can understand the plants and we can understand the animals. We kind of got most people have got a bit of a understanding of that. But when you start talking about a whale or something swimming into an area without oxygen, you're talking about killing it, asphyxiating it straight away.
Mm.
Can't live.
Yeah.
And what else can't live there, you know? And what else is going to bloom and take over and all of that sort of thing? If you start translating what you know about being on the surface of our world as we know it, this terrestrial world, and putting it into the sea, it becomes... You start to understand algae blooms and all of that sort of stuff.
Human populations are a number, and our technology is such where we can destroy parts of our environment totally. And sometimes this is often done by greed, short-term profits.
Yeah.
Slash and burn agriculture.
Exactly. And we've got to
remember. You're not separate from it.
Exactly.
Yes. I mean, it's actually part of our system as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can talk about the ecosystem in a rainforest, and you can talk about ecosystem in the, you know, as you see in the desert and all of these seven different varieties of the world, if you like, that Attenborough does, but it's all part of one ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And if you destroy part of that ecosystem, that will have roll-on effects and all of the rest of it.
Yeah. Well, looking back, again, it's going ahead and some of the things we could look at. In the past, there has been mass extinctions.
That's right.
And I'm talking about in what the worst one was about something like over 95% of all living things.
Yeah, even more on, I think.
Perished. All right. So these things can happen by natural, but the mass extinctions we're beginning to see on the planet now are not due to natural causes. They are due to human beings.
And the thing is, the Earth will survive, yeah, and it will probably get life back, even if you did that. Life would regenerate, just not us.
Yeah.
And not multicellular things like us, you know, not for a very, very long time. So it's bye-bye the problem makers.
During the COVID lockdown, when the world basically switched off, I was astonished at how quickly the animals and also the plants started taking over the cities.
Oh, it doesn't take very long at all.
It doesn't take very long at all. If you give nature half a chance, nature's going to rebound and move back, but we have to give nature that chance.
Mm.
Anyway, that's my ecological conservationist.
I think we have to find a way not to fight it so much, but to work with it.
Yes.
It's the whole thing. It's a change of the way we see it. Like we take down the forest and we put in the farms, you know, or we put in something else. The forest is disappearing at an incredible rate around the world. But instead of doing that, we have to find a way that we can work with it so that we're actually maintaining, getting what we need, but also maintaining the ecosystem of the world.
Mm-hmm.
For the different regions, because otherwise you don't get the rain that you need for the crops that you put in. You know, I mean, you don't get the fertility in the soil to grow them. You're trying to put in artificial stuff and that causes another problem. You know, it's just a case of working with it
nature,
rather than against it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that takes a lot of understanding.
This is why I'm very keen on learning how to help the African farmers, as just as an example, work with the wildlife. You know, particularly the carnivores, the lions and leopards and that sort of thing.
Are
killing their stock, and so they kill all the lions and leopards. And as a result, the entire ecosystem, the local ecosystem, is just completely in chaos as a result of this, because they believe the only solution is to go out and.
It's a simple solution.
Africa and the wildlife there is a remnant of where we came from in the first place.
Yes.
You know, the whole human history. And we're in a day, it's got the greatest variety of life there, and we're in great danger of wiping it out. You know, it is,
Anyway, we must get back to Arcturus and Vega.
We've gone to Vega. Now, I've gone to Arcturus, which is the fourth brightest star in the entire sky. It's dead easy to pick it up. You can see it quite easily in the night sky in the evening when you look into the north, all right? And Arcturus is in the constellation of Boötes, all right? And he is the herdsman, all right? Now, let's have a look at I've got a photograph of Arcturus. I've just brought it up there. And you can see it's also got colour in this photograph here. It's yellowy-orange colour. And let's bring up Vega alongside it, and you can immediately, your eyes can detect the differences, all right?
When you look at that, you know that star, that cross, light across, there's two beams of light across it. People might be curious as to whether that happens. It's an effect of a lens.
It's a telescope.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the bars that hold it, yeah.
It's real, but if you looked at the star with some other instrument, it wouldn't be there.
You wouldn't see the crosses, no.
It's caused by the telescope itself.
That's right, yeah. That's right. But anyway, the important point is to look at the difference in colour. We said that Vega was a lot hotter than our sun. Arcturus is quite a bit cooler, and you can see the difference in colour. The radiation emitted by stars depends upon their temperature.
Yes.
And we look up at night and we say, oh, the stars all appear to be white. And the reason for that is that our eyes use two different cells to see, rods and cones. The cones give us colour vision, the rods give us black and white, but the rod cells are the most sensitive.
They're much more sensitive than
the cone cells. That's right. And when the light level drops down, the cones stop working, and so everything appears in black and white. So when you go out at night, all the colours you could see in your garden, they disappear because you're using your rods. And exactly the same when we look at the stars, they appear white. But I tell you what, the moment you begin to look through big telescopes at them, there's enough coming through to trigger your cones.
Quite spectacular colour.
And you see the colours, yes.
That's right.
Yes. That's right.
That colour tells you the temperature.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. The bluer it is, the hotter it is.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, now, here I've just brought up the information on Arcturus. Its distance is just under 37 light years. But look at the interesting thing. Its mass is only 8% bigger. So it's about the same mass as the Sun, but it's 170 times brighter. Right. And the reason for this is that Arcturus is an ancient star. I've just brought up another little image showing Arcturus alongside the Sun to scale.
Yes.
You see how big it is, all right? Its diameter is 25 times that of the Sun, and it rotates on its axis in 2 years.
But if its mass is only 1.8, then it's not as dense as our Sun, is it?
No, well, it is dense in the centre, but what we're seeing is that all the outer layers, yeah, which have
expanded. The outside out, must be more like atmosphere, really.
Yeah. Yes, the outer layers have been all spread out.
Yeah.
But the important point here is that Arcturus is a lot older than our Sun. Mm. And what we're looking at now with Arcturus is what the Sun's going to look like.
That's what it's going to evolve into.
Our Sun, yeah, when it runs out of hydrogen fuel at the centre, is going to evolve into a red giant like this. Its age there, I just pulled up, is 7.1 billion years, right? So you can see that it's over 3 billion years older than the Earth and the Sun, okay? Well, yeah, that's what it's going to look like from here in Carterton in AD 6027.
Well, you won't need heaters, Sunday, will you?
I won't be scraping ice off the car like I did this morning.
It's not that the Earth's going to glow red, hard and melt on the face.
We won't be there.
No, we won't. That's right. So you see, so what we see as life on Earth, all these wonderful things we were talking about, is a little moment in time, right?
Yeah, when it's that it's can't, well, it does have life fairly early on, but the life is very primitive.
Yeah, it takes a while.
And then it develops up and you get all these other problems that happen with swings and roundabouts. And then you have a little time when it's glorious and then it starts to get impossible. Yeah. Only we're making the impossible closer.
Anyway, if we go back to looking at our bright stars, and Vega, which we were talking about in the beginning, close to Vega, in the harp there is the remnant of a star which once upon a time was a red giant but is no more.
Mm.
And it's a magnificent object. It's called the Ring Nebula. Its distance, however, is 2,750 light years. I'll bring you up a photograph. There it is.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah. And what we're looking at here is what we were just talking about earlier. This star was once upon a time a star like our Sun. It then turned into a red giant. And then in its final life period, it begins to eject its outer layers off. Yes. And that's what you can see there. And the different colours come from the fact that those shells of matter
are different
compositions, yeah.
Like neon lights, circular neon lights of different colours.
Hydrogen there and helium and oxygen.
Yeah.
And neon too, yes.
Now, I'm just bringing up some other photographs of it as taken at different wavelengths. From this, what we discovered, that it started to expand 1,600 years ago, so AD 416.
Mm.
Before that, you looked at where
there's a star.
There would be a red giant star there, like Arcturus, and now it's turned into this nebula.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Mm. Stunning, though.
Beautiful nebula. Yeah.
Let's have a look in some more detail. All right. Look at that. This is some of the latest photographs. And that's
that's from the James Webb.
That's right, yeah.
Mm. You can see how it's flying out.
And yet you can see all the structure there.
And that the remnant of the star is one of those, is that little dot right in the middle, isn't
right
it?
Right at the centre.
Yeah.
there is the core of what's left over, and that's what we call a white dwarf. And this would be super dense. You get a teaspoonful of that matter there, and it weighs tons, right? Because it's all being compressed.
Very densely compressed.
That's right, yeah. A weird and wonderful
it's
thing.
It's mainly car. Is it carbon, mainly? What is it?
Well, it all depends on the type of star, how massive the star, but a lot of it will be carbon. And, of course, at that pressure...
It would be diamonds.
It's going to be a diamond the size of the Earth, right?
Yes, like a diamond.
But if you land on it, it's not very healthy.
You would be flattened over an area the size of a football field, yes.
Yeah, not very easy to mine.
No, we'll be a rush on because we're just about running out of time. So remember, you can come out and take a tour into the past at Stonehenge Aotearoa, open Wednesday to Sunday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pardon? What? Yes, I know. I have to change that bit on there. Okay then, folks. And we'll catch up with you in the near future. Now, we will put a program together where we're looking at the origin and evolution of our solar system. Okay,
yes.
And we'll put something like that on. Okay.
Let's look forward to it.
Yeah.
Okay.